Hey there and welcome to The Gong Show. My name's Steph Postuma. I'll be joined by Wollongong chefs Andy Burns and Simon Evans to talk about issues that relate to food and hospitality, with insights from guests including chefs, business owners, producers, policymakers and experts. This week's a special episode of The Gong Show. On the 24th of November 2018, we took part in the Wollongong Writers Festival and did a live podcast about their theme, What Feeds You? So in this podcast, we talk about what feeds chefs in terms of creativity and inspiration. And we also talk about what nourishes chefs in terms of things that help with pushing forward in a challenging industry. The sound on this one isn't the best because we did it to a live audience, but we really hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a new thing for us, and we really, really enjoyed being part of the Wollongong Writers Festival this year. And thank you to Linda and the whole team that made it possible. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you like this episode. Let's get into it.
And now, please join me in warmly welcoming Steffi Postuma, Simon Evans and Andy Burns.
Thank you, Linda. Can you all hear us?
Yeah.
All right, yeah, cool. Welcome. This is the first time we've done a live podcast. We'll talk about the Gong Show in a second, but we'd also like to acknowledge the Dharawal people who are the traditional custodians of the land of the Illawarra, and pay respect to elders past, present, and the future. So, if you don't know what the Gong Show is, it's a podcast that we started together. We'll introduce ourselves in a sec, but it's essentially we sort of work in food. I'm a publisher, I make cookbooks, and these guys are both chefs and business owners here in Wollongong. And we started it originally as a means of communicating ideas and thoughts around the food industry and potentially sort of challenges that face the hospitality industry, and then also just diving into aspects of the food and hospitality industry that might not be discussed on a public level as much. A lot of food media is very short form and catchy. Celebrity chefs are a big thing. Publications make their money off promoting large chefs that have a large profile, and there's a lot of chefs and business owners out there who work really, really hard with such passion and creativity, and they don't necessarily have a platform to communicate their ideas. So that is kind of the reason why we started this podcast. So just to introduce ourselves, my name is Stephen Postuma, and I run Quicksand Food and Quicksand Publishing, and we make regional cookbooks. So I brought a couple of them along. This one is the most recent one that we did here in Wollongong. It's the Illawarra Cookbook, and what we do is we showcase regional food culture by collating recipes from sort of the best chefs around different regions of New South Wales. And we also profile different producers, and we put them together in nice pretty books that people can cook from. And I mean, we do a bunch of other stuff, but let's just focus on publishing for today, as it is the Writers Festival. Simon, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Simon Evans. I own a restaurant in Wollongong. We have a big focus on local and native foods. We're right in the centre of town, Kerry Street.
Andy Byrne from Baby Face Kitchen and Two Smoking Barrels and Two Smoking Barrels Food Truck. And I predominantly work at Baby Face Kitchen, and I'm just down the road from Simon on Kerry Street as well.
Yeah, and I got to know both of these guys through publishing this book. It's when we first met, and I was kind of doing interviews with chefs and things like that. I've got a degree in journalism, also do a radio show here in Wollongong. And these guys kind of came to me one day and said, why don't we do a podcast and keep talking about these things, because these are sort of important issues to discuss and stuff. So, and that's where we're at. And I guess that's why we're here today. So, I mean, how do you guys feel about being artists for the day? You get to talk about your inspiration and creativity. So this is a really unique platform for chefs. Chefs don't get the opportunity to do that sort of stuff.
Yeah, we were kind of questioning our, I guess, legitimacy in the area.
Imposter syndrome going on.
Chefs get elevated to think of artists quite often, and most of the time it doesn't really feel like that when you're working day in and day out in the kitchen. It's a bit more of a trade, so I'm uneasy.
Well, it is a trade.
Artist too, but we'll go with it.
Okay, well, so today, I mean, the theme of this year's festival, and I've got to thank Linda and everyone that was involved in putting this festival together, because they're such important important things for creativity in the community, and especially with what feeds you, this idea of sort of what feeds and nourishes people, fostering creativity and artists in a small place like the Illawarra is so important. So thank you. The way we're going to structure what we're doing today, I guess, we're just going to talk about, we're going to keep it really simple. We're going to talk about what feeds you and focus on creativity and inspiration. And there's a lot of different things that can sort of fall into when it comes to food and hospitality. And then we'll talk a bit about what nourishes you and how chefs, business owners, publishers. I've got to not forget to talk a bit about making books as well, guys. The podcast is about food, and we rarely actually talk about publishing and making books. But about what nourishes you guys and what keeps that creativity flowing in the support networks that you have, and how that might be different to the communities and the support that you would find as another different type of artist. So let's start with what feeds you. So creativity, I guess, is found in all aspects of hospitality, and it especially is, I mean, at the very base level, and you guys both have experience with this, you need to, when you open a restaurant, you need to develop a concept that's going to not only work for you and feed you, but it's also going to quite literally feed the public, and also resonate with them to a level where they'll keep returning and you'll have a successful business. So when it comes to beginning a restaurant, I'll start with you, Simon. What inspired you? You can tell us a bit of the story about how you guys started with Kavo, but sort of what inspired you and how do you go about developing a concept and what you want to do?
So I think with us especially, it was myself and his partner Tom, we've been chefs for a while, we've worked around, and the ambition is for most chefs is to own a restaurant. It's kind of the only ambition you can really have as a chef, some of the other places to go. So you spend years thinking about what you want to do, the food you like to cook, the ingredients you want to use, the way you want a restaurant to look, restaurants you've been to you like, chefs you look up to, things like that. So you kind of have a set plan when you go into it, what you should do. And then after that is kind of read the market. So that's the creative kind of happy, let's do it one side. Then the realism of it is you also have to run a business. That's kind of like the hard bit that kind of does crush your creativity in that sense a bit, but it kind of makes you be creative in different ways. So you've got to be creative within the market that you're working in, and work around those parameters. So it kind of there's so many levels to creativity. We were discussing this the other day. It's so tiered. I think the one that people look at to start with is what's on the plate, the dish you're doing, and how you're being creative in that. But there's so many more areas to it, from your restaurant design to actually trying to make money in a creative way is kind of key as well.
Andy, developing a restaurant?
Well, as Simon said, there's a whole bunch to it. I guess we started with an empty shell at our restaurant, Babyface, and we started with the idea of the way we like to come together and eat, which was like communally. So all our dishes are designed to share. So it started there for us, but so much more comes into it. I mean, if you had an endless cash stream, it would probably really help. And you could buy all the produce you wanted and all the lovely wine you wanted and design the place exactly how you want it. So there are definitely limiting factors.
Would that make you less creative though?
Sorry?
Do you reckon that make you less creative?
Oh, maybe. Well, as Simon said, like, you have to become more creative in the sense that you've got to use every single bit of the produce you buy, etc., etc. And it makes you think very hard, and sometimes when you're running a business you don't have an endless cash stream, and you have to really think about what products you're buying, how you're going to use them, and keeping your customers as interested as you'd like as well. Expectation.
You kind of want to have everything, so you're like, oh, I want this ingredient and that wine. But I think sometimes like the best things come from when you're forced to do something.
Definitely.
Forced creativity. Like, this is all I have, or this little off cut, or this piece, what can I do with that? I think that's where a lot of creativity in dishes actually comes from.
Or it could be a mistake. Like we were talking about the other day, you can have an idea in your head of like, oh, I really want to get this, and then we're going to do this with it, and we're going to bring it all together in this perfect formation on the plate, and it gets to the plate, and you kind of think to yourself, wow, that looks really shit.
Pretty much, yeah.
But
time to get creative.
There could be a couple of components from it that worked really well. And you might think, you know, after a couple of years in a restaurant, you develop yourself a pretty nice pantry. We've got a lot of things that take a year to produce, up to a year, misos, etc. So you might pull one of them out, add it to a component of that, change it, and then three plates later, goes on the menu.
Yeah.
I think there's different ways of getting there.
I think most people think of creativity as like a spark or like kind of that, like that eureka moment where it's like, ah, perfect dish. But it's not really like that in the kitchen.
It's definitely not like that.
Everything's on the fly.
You were telling me, Simon, that there's certain dishes, I mean, you would run a seasonal menu, like change a menu, you know, generally sort of like four times a year. But it's like in the last 2 weeks of a season that you feel like you've perfected a certain dish on the menu because you've done it then that many times and honed it and sharpened it to a point where it gets to the end of the season and it's on there for 2 weeks and you're like, this is exactly where I want this dish to be, and then it comes off the menu
and we change it. Yeah.
Or there's that like limbo period, like because of the way the weather's been.
Yeah.
The season's changed differently this year. So some of the produce stayed longer, some of it wasn't coming through when we usually want it to. So you've got this idea in your head of, I'm going to use this at this time and it's going to be great because I've been thinking about this since last year, what we can do with this, and then it's not ready. So yeah, you've got to hold on to the dishes, maybe slightly change them, because again, your customers need to be interested, our regulars need to stay interested.
Yeah, exactly. I think like Steph is getting at is that a dish isn't perfect the first time you do it. A restaurant concept or design isn't perfect the first time you do it. It's constant evolution, constant change, which makes it look perfect if you come in at the right time and the dish has been perfected.
What do you think, and you touched on it just before, I think if we call you guys artists, and me, I guess, we're all running businesses it's very apparent that it's a business and it's also a creative outlet. Whereas with other art forms, sometimes the business aspect of it might not be talked about as much or come into it as much as a restaurant, because a restaurant is so obviously a small business. But I think that yourselves, me definitely, and other artists out there always face this challenge of wanting to be as creative as you possibly can be. Do exactly what you want to do, but also making it fit the needs of the market so you can support yourself. So do you see that, like you were saying just before, Simon, that is kind of one of these parameters that's set for you and you have to find creative ways of addressing that. Is that a challenge that you sort of embrace? Do you wish you had a bit more sort of financial freedom essentially to be able to pursue creativity in other ways?
Yeah, I think a lot of time it's the market which dictates what you can do. Same as if you're writing your novel you're passionate about, or if you're writing articles for something to pay the bills, it's going to equate to that. So it depends what you can do in your market. It depends what customers are going to want to come in and eat, really. I know we could put some pretty out there products and meats on, but if no one wants to actually come in and try them, then what's the point? Probably nothing worse than the lonely artist in a quiet restaurant with these amazing dishes and no one eating it. I mean, the whole point in this is to get people in to have dinner and enjoy themselves. So I think you can, again, too much into chefs being artists, I think you can lead to them putting...
chefs being broke?
Yeah, well, yeah. Popular idea of the broke artist. We'll cook for money.
I'm going to bring it to what I do a little bit as well. Like in publishing cookbooks, these books, we definitely have to work within the parameters of a business model and addressing a market as well and find ways to be able to sort of do it creatively within that. So with this publication, for example, the Illawarra Cookbook, we feature something like 50 different businesses around the Illawarra. One of the hard things for us is that we could feature 150 different farms, businesses, producers, anyone that has anything to do with food in the Illawarra. However, that means that the book would then be, instead of 200 and something pages, 220 pages or so, it would be 500 pages. And that means if you were going to make a book that's 500 pages, the book would then have to sell for $80 and people would purchase it. So we have a bunch of those sorts of parameters, I guess, that we have to follow in order to make a book that has market appeal. It needs to sort of tick a lot of boxes. The book in the publishing industry is extremely, you know, there's a lot of competition, and we compete with the likes of Jamie Oliver and Gordon Ramsay, all these sorts of people, because our books sit next to those books on the shelves in bookstores, and we need to find ways of making our books be picked up by the public. And one way which seems to work for us is the idea of having people connect to our books on a personal level, in the sense that they know the people that are involved, like you guys, because there's photos of you guys in the book. Not great ones, but no, they're all right. You know, the food that they might have eaten at your places, the beaches that they might walk on, the dairy in Kiama Pines Dairy, for example, like hear the story about them, and that's the milk that you might buy from your local grocer.
I think that's the difference with your books, is that they show the local regions. It's not just restaurants and cafes and bars, it's producers and, you know, people at markets, things like that. So it's got that, it hits kind of every level in that market. If you just have a book full of restaurant recipes, it's not really accessible.
Exactly. Like, I mean, you can make a recipe book, and then you can make something that people, you know, really want to pick up. And I guess the other challenge that I find sort of creatively, that it takes a long time during the development stages of making a cookbook, is accurately representing the culture and aesthetic of food within a region, because every place is different. So I've done books in Canberra, the Southern Highlands, here in the Illawarra, and the South Coast, which kind of we've called basically sort of Kiama all the way down to Eden. And each of these regions have a very different aesthetic. They've got a different food community. They've got, obviously, you know, different restaurants, those sorts of things involved, different climates, different histories. And it's important, it's very important for us to do justice to all those things when it comes to the production and presentation of a book. So what we do is we sort of start, we research history and take inspiration from the landscapes. For example, this book is split into three chapters, which aesthetically represent the mountains, the land, and the sea, these different features of the Illawarra landscape. And we kind of find that if we really try to do justice, do both aesthetic justice and sort of pay homage to the culture and history of a place in those ways, we can make a product that does that accurately represents a region and kind of looks good and people want to buy it. So
is that where you find the most creativity in producing a book in those?
It's a really fun period of the publication, because I work closely with my designer. And it's a really kind of cool iterative process about, like, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Like, for example, the font that's used on the front of this cookbook for the title is an old one that she found that was used in steel manufacturing, where they'd stamp steel with their marks using this big bold font, because you can't use you can't use Times New Roman with a crazy sort of cast iron stamp to stamp a big beam or something like that. So
you should tell people.
Railroad Gothic.
Yeah. Is that Microsoft Word?
No.
Right.
It's fancy one. But so it's those sorts of things, like that. Those sorts of things that, even though it's not obvious and you wouldn't know it unless I told you about it, but it kind of all sort of works together to make something that represents the Illawarra.
And it did work really well. I think it's a great representation.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, okay. You work so closely, Steph works so closely with all of us in each section of that book to, I guess, get our creativity to come across on the pages through the photos and the conversations we have. I didn't know Steph before that book at all, and now we do this together, we're quite good friends. Like, that's how closely he works with everyone, I guess, to get his vision out of his head onto the pages, and it must be pretty challenging.
It is. It's really fucking challenging. All right, let's move on. Creativity in making a dish. I mean, you guys have to change your menu all the time, and there's a world out there of options for you in terms of ingredients, in terms of inspiration, all these sorts of things. So when you have to, when you want to make a new dish, sign must start with you again. How do you, like, where do you start? You're a blank plate.
I mean, for us, we start with the what we can get. We try and let the local farmers and the weather and the season dictate the menu. Otherwise, you start with like infinite possibilities, because especially in Australia, where you can get most ingredients most times a year, maybe not even from Australia, we need something to start us off. So whether it's our local farmers are growing some fennel, or if this fish is coming this season, or we've just found this new thing we can get, it's always got to start with an ingredient for us. And then from there, it's kind of working out what goes with what. I think people can get a bit wacky with food in the name of creativity and just start throwing ingredients and throwing weird stuff. And then you might taste it the first time and it's different, and different sometimes is quite a good shock. It's like, wow, I've never tasted anything like that. Doesn't mean it's good. Could still be rubbish. Just because you haven't tasted anything like that might be for a reason. Maybe we should have gone together. So I think it's always got to be based in something. So especially me, everything's got to have a reason on the plate, which kind of is a detriment sometimes, but like it's got to be there because that goes with that classically, or that flavor works.
So I want you to break down how you went about it for that that duck dish that you had on, which was kind of one of the highlights of your last menu. And tell us a little bit about it practically, because I think people are interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's quite good actually. So we ducks from Thirlmere, sort of Southern Highlands way. We wanted to use them, really good local product. And then we had some Illawarra plum, which we kind of wanted to find the perfect fruit for a restaurant in Illawarra. It's native fruit as well. So we wanted to get that on. And then duck glazed in plums, quite a sort of classic Asian dish, and that kind of lent themselves to each other very, very well. So that just kind of made sense in my head. And then also we had another grower down in Dapto who had beetroots and radicchio growing at the same time. So they were there. Colours worked as well. Everything was there. There's a very purple.
Beautiful purple dish.
Yeah. So everything kind of fell in place with that. So there was local stuff, there was native things we wanted to use. Colours were right. And sometimes it's just little things like that where those colours work together, therefore that makes sense to me. I can put them on a plate. And then obviously the most important thing, and sometimes the last thing you check is actually it tastes good. Luckily it tasted good. You can spend a lot of time with playing around with a dish that conceptually is amazing and doesn't taste good, and that's got to be the defining factor of a dish.
Andy, how do you start when you're thinking about a dish, blank plate?
It is very similar to what Simon said, but we don't focus quite so locally as Simon does. We're pretty dictated by what my fisho can get for me, what we can get off our butcher.
That's a fish supply, fishmonger industry chat.
For instance, he sent me a text at 3 a.m. because he couldn't get the snapper from Chris Bolton, who is a fisherman from North Queensland, because he didn't catch enough this morning, or yesterday morning, sorry. So it's dictated by, so we had to change that, and I'll have to fix that when I get to work after this kind of thing. So we'll
live creativity.
We'll
be on the menu tonight.
It's happening right now. So yeah, that dictates what goes in our menu. Simon has a tasting menu. The difference for us is we have an a la carte menu. So we have a few more dishes, I'd say. But it is dictated by what meat. A lot of the meat we buy, there is obviously only so much of it. That comes off animals, and we buy unique cuts that, again, there is only so much of. So for instance, one of the cuts we use, there might be 40 kilos a month. So if I use all of that, I have to change the beef that's on our menu. They all require different cooking times, different methods of getting them to where we want to get them to. So that, for us, plays a big part. Our vegetables, the droughts had a big effect on what goes in our menu. As I mentioned before, with the seasons changing, etc., but it's also been a matter of availability. We've got a farm that grows for us called Moonacres Farm in Fitzroy Falls in Southern Highlands, and another farm called Epicurean Harvest that grows for us there in Hartley, just through the Blue Mountains. But they've been strongly affected by the drought, so that rolls onto us and affects supply coming to us. So that is a massive part of how we put our dishes together. I get a text on Sundays from both farms telling me what they have available. They pick it for us on Tuesday, it gets delivered to the restaurant on Wednesday. A lot of the time, they will have the same thing for a period of time, so we'll taste it. And then, as I mentioned, we'll use our pantry, I guess, to bring different flavours points of difference to the dish. We use a lot of Korean and Japanese influence in our cooking at the restaurant. So this all comes into what we're going to do with each product, and then we try and bring it together.
So my question is, you start off by being inspired by the ingredients that you have available to you, and then but you don't just put them on the plate and send, like, you don't open a bag of meat and just put it on a plate and send it to the customer. There's a lot that happens in between the ingredients and what goes to the customer. So where is it within you that you have like these little light bulb moments of creativity and inspiration that you're like, shit, like, okay, we've got this available, like, you know, can you sort of take us into your head at all when you're playing around with a new dish of, and you know, it is just the ingredients, but it's also what you have available, but then there's also some spark inside.
A lot of it, I think, is experience for me. Like, what have I done with this in the past? And the people around you as well, like, it's not just me. Someone might come up with one component of a dish, or they might have come up with something 6 months ago that didn't work with something else. And we might bring it back to be a part of, like, okay, that's perfect with that sort of marble score 9 rib blade meat that's incredibly rich and fatty, and we need some acidity to cut through that. It could be a side for the dish. So it's different people, different ideas. And you try and bring it to it. It's not just this, moment of clarity.
It's memory and recall, really. Like, it's 10 years of cooking for me. And how many for you, Andy? Quite a few, though.
Yeah, 19, 20.
Look at it. So it's all that experience that you bring to one moment of making a dish. I'm constantly looking at other restaurants, other ingredients, and other techniques. I might see something, and it might not come into my head until like a year or two later. When I'm doing a dish, I need this component, it needs some acidity, or it needs this, or it needs some texture. Literally might just come in my head and be like, oh, you saw that thing once, what was that? And then you might go and play with it, and it kind of works. But it's not, I was thinking it's less of a spark, it's more of just literally having
and one thing we haven't yet touched on, but I think is important, and you kind of just mentioned it then, is the inspiration that you get from others in the industry. Because there's a lot of restaurants out there and a lot of chefs, and you guys who are within the industry keep very, very close attention to what's happening in the industry, who's doing what, which chefs are innovating and doing interesting things. And I think when it comes to you guys, in terms of inspiration, for example, if I was an author or if I published cookbooks, no, more so I'm talking about being a writer, if you write novels. If you want to absorb new information from your peers, other authors, you have to read books. Now it takes a long time to read a book. However, with you guys, you can look online, you can read good food, you can like have a look through Instagram of some of your favorite chefs and restaurants and those sorts of things. And when you see what they're doing, because you're a chef, also you're trained in the same way, you can understand what they've done. And you can get that immediate sort of inspiration and knowledge. Like, oh, okay, so there's something that I haven't seen before. Maybe research a technique or research an ingredient that you haven't seen before. So there's a lot of inspiration outside of what you guys do and the ingredients that you have to be taken from the industry, which is massive.
Yeah, it's pretty instant now with social media. And someone else does a dish and they want to show it off to everyone. Probably the same, as soon as you come up with something you think's new and creative, it's straight on social media because you want to see what other people think. You want other people to, you kind of almost want to put your stamp on it and put it out there before anyone else does it.
Is this okay?
Yeah. Always gotta check.
Am I crazy?
But I think there's because creativity is basically not copying other people, and then in cooking,
Big difference.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard. It's hard to have a kind of unique idea. But then there's obviously certain things that have been done for so long that you sort of can use them because they're classic. But then if you see someone who's done something unique and clever with an ingredient, you know you can't do that for a couple of years until it becomes normalised. You can't just steal it straight away. It's always really annoying because you're like, oh, it's so obvious. Oh,
why did I think of that?
Yeah.
You want to be the guy thinking of it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's truly hard. There's really only a couple of chefs in the world who create things that have never been done before in any kind of way.
Mm. Interesting. And I guess there's always, like, I think we've talked about it before on this podcast, but there's always the parameters, like you said, of stuff has to taste good. And there's, like, the reason that there is the term flavor balance is because, you know, the right amount of sweet, salty, sour, hot, or whatever needs to be balanced in order for a dish to taste good. Like, if you just throw a bunch of salty things on a plate because they're interesting new ingredients and they look nice, it's not going to taste good. So you do work within these sorts of parameters as well.
It can be one thing as well. Like last night, we made a sauce with smoked young garlic, some chicken stock, and emulsified with butter. But it was just lacking something, and so we put some of our just reduced chicken stock with some soy and fermented shiitake, and it just finished it completely. Like we're in a couple of like 100 mil.
Yeah.
It was bad, and then it was perfect.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems with internet and social media is that you can look at something and go, oh my god, that's amazing, but you haven't tasted it. You've looked at it. So it can be a bit of envy over something that might actually not be any good.
Oh, there's plenty of stuff that looks really good. Wow. You just pour liquid nitrogen on something and take a photo of it and it looks great.
Yeah.
So this is all sort of you applying your trade, but also you have to put it on a plate and make it look pretty, essentially. How are you inspired? And I think this is where sort of trend comes in quite a bit. But how are you inspired with putting things on a plate, the art of plating, as it were?
It's a hashtag, isn't it?
It is. It's an Instagram account.
Yeah. Definitely trends come into play. You can almost, if you look at a dish, you can always put it to a decade of how it's been plated. Or someone's going a bit retro with something. And they change and they go and people kind of push it. But I mean, that's kind of the one thing that really, I think, is a bit more artistic. And some people just have a really good eye for, obviously, colours and plating and space and can make dishes look very pretty. Other than that, it's just following general rules. Like three little edible flowers will look better than four for some reason. Like little things like
Or it could be five.
Trial and error. Like little things like that, you get taught which kind of do stay true. You go follow. Sometimes it depends on your food. Like we play different to Andy because Andy's food's different. And the flavor's different, the color's different. But I think the most basic point, which I got taught really early on in my career, was food that's cooked well looks good naturally. Like a well cooked, well rested steak just looks good on its own. Mm. So there's half the battle, is just making sure everything is actually executed well.
Just do it properly.
How much does the practicality of service come into the way you plate stuff? Because you might have to send 100 of one dish out in a night or whatever it is, and you need to make sure that your time, you know, you can't be sitting there tweezering, you know, 12 different ingredients onto each plate.
It's huge for us. Like we'll have some dishes that are quite intricately plated and some that are very simply, and it can be, if they were all for us, because we've got so many dishes, like maybe 20 things on the a la carte menu from top to bottom, including sides. If they were all very intricately plated, we'd be right in the shit.
Yeah. Start plating now. I think it makes a massive difference. You could do something that's amazingly elaborate and beautiful, but if you can't actually execute it during service, or if it's not going to look the same during service when you're trying to feed 50 people, there's no point in doing it, and you might have to strip it back.
That's a big point.
That comes from experience in a bit. You might play something when you're trialing it, and you look at it, you're like, that's never going to work. So you know,
looks great.
And I mean, even little things like if the produce isn't right, that's going to look as well. So you've got to even think about, like, am I going to get the consistency of that certain thing to highlight that in a certain way? So there's a lot of factors that come in, but definitely.
Can we portion that beef exactly the same?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, a piece of meat or a piece of fish, the tail end is different to the top end. So even that, like, sometimes we'll have a dish on with a piece of fish, and because I have to cut it differently, depending on which side I'm using, we might plate it slightly differently depending on that cut. Which isn't ideal, but that's the, you know,
it's reality.
Food doesn't always come in a perfect
one square. Thing that might be that sort of might cross over from, you know, traditional artists, for example, a painter in into what you guys do, and it comes into, I guess, the art of plating is the idea of restraint, and they do use that a lot in food media these days. I think that perhaps less experienced chefs or whatever might have the proclivity to keep adding stuff when it might already be finished, and that might come into the way you present something, but also the concept of a dish in general. It's also, and you can just speak on this, is how much is it around finding a point where the dish is just done and you don't need to add any more texture, you don't need to add any more color, you have to trust that it looks good on the plate and the way you present it, you don't need to cover it in flowers or dust.
It's exactly
talking about
that
restraint.
Like, there can be like the final leaf, I think. But I guess it's different for each person though. Like, you might think something looks really good and I might think that way too much on that.
Yeah, it really much depends on your food. Like, if you're working at a very, like we do an 8-course tasting menu, so our portions are small. It's a big meal overall, don't believe what people say. But each dish is quite small, and things small on a plate just tend to look a little bit more pretty. If you're working in a bistro, and even you're doing steak and chips, which is a great meal, nothing taken away. You can't just put three little Latisse chips across the steak, a couple of dots of sauce, and a couple of leaves. Yeah, it's not going to work. You can't do a deconstructed pie. It's not a pie. Bits.
You can. People have tried.
Probably not.
We've got to move on to what nourishes you. And hospitality is a very challenging industry. High stress across probably all facets of it. What keeps you going? What is the thing? What are the things that keep you interested? That make you keep pushing, you know, yourself in a new direction, because it can be bloody tough. And in a place like Wollongong, you're not necessarily always busy. And I'll talk a little bit about books after you guys have a crack at this one with what nourishes you as chefs and what keeps you going.
So the good thing about owning a restaurant is you get constant feedback, which is good sometimes, not always. So people will always tell you what they think about your food. Just lovely of them, good or bad. So you get instant feedback. As if you're a painter or a writer, that takes a while to get. So you might spend a long time doing something, and then you get your feedback after the kind of fact. So we constantly, generally, get told our food is good. People like it, and that keeps you going. And that feedback shows you on the right path. Other things like reviews, guidebooks. We're constantly being judged favorably.
So I guess that can be a bit of a blessing and a curse. It's different to, again, probably traditional artists in the sense that you don't have as a publisher, mostly, like, and probably with authors as well, you don't always have direct contact with your clientele. People anonymously buy a book off a bookshelf, go home, put it under the Christmas tree, and you never hear anything about it. I've got one Google review for my business, and it says, great book.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the feedback I get, other than like when I meet people who have the books. For you guys, it's completely the other end of the spectrum, where you have an outward-facing business front and a system of reviews and feedback that can be both brutal and really cool at the same time.
Maybe let's stick with the positive side of it.
Yeah.
No, I think just the acknowledgement I guess, from your peers in the industry. Industry acknowledgement's a big one that kind of feeds me, I guess. Your customers, your guests, like having a great experience. They're, you know, in your restaurant that you built for a few hours, and they have a great night and they tell you about it. That's, I think, the best acknowledgement that you can get. That's why we're there. And I think your family and friends is a pretty important one. Feeding your family.
What about the Wollongong hospitality community?
Wollongong hospitality crew's great, even better now. There's so many young people that have come through and done their own thing. And we all work pretty closely together and support one another. And I think that's really important, because it can be a pretty challenging and sometimes negative industry. And I think the other thing that's really challenging is sometimes, like, you can work 80 hours a week and you have to stay positive and creative. It's pretty hard to be creative when you're exhausted, but that's a big part of it, and that's a big challenge for me, especially. That challenges me.
Yeah, I think when you spend so much time, like I said, 80 hours a week, and you put your whole life and your whole soul into what you do, into your dishes, into your restaurant, when a table comes in, has a really good night, has nothing but nice things to say, leaves you a great review, and just leaves looking happy, looking like they've just, you've added something to their life, that's huge. That's why we do what we do. That's what makes all the hard work and the hours worthwhile. And that really is that's what keeps you going. Everything else is kind of a bonus. Industry respect and reviews, things like that, but you know, feeling like you've made a slight difference to someone's night, even in a small way, by feeding them, is that's why we do it.
That's great. And I guess, for me, it's a similar thing. I think that, like, I have a lot of, I sort of question my abilities sometimes, and question how things work, because I don't get that feedback. It's challenging, because you kind of need positive affirmation to keep you going, but when I do get it, I really value it. So I might just bump into someone on the street or meet a new person or something, and one of these books is sort of laying around, and someone goes, I know that book, I gave it to my mum for Christmas, she loves it. And just little things like that, because, like, these people I might not know. Like, I kind of live in a world where I just assume that the people that I know that I make these books, but there's also actually, like, a large public out there that has my books that I don't even think about, get any feedback from. But yeah, any of that, any feedback. And the thing that does keep me going is that, fortunately, unlike you guys, I don't get any negative feedback. Everyone who gives me feedback says that they love my books, and that's what keeps me going. Because I don't know, the publishing world's a weird world, and in terms of peers and others in the industry and stuff, you're always comparing yourself to others, and for me, being an independent publisher, that can be difficult. Seeing the new Yotam Ottolenghi book that's coming out in stacks of 100 in the biggest bookshops in Australia or whatever, these sales quantities and all those sorts of things, comparing myself to those is hard, but the feedback's always good, and people like it.
When you perhaps release a book tomorrow.
Yeah, we're going to launch tomorrow.
Is that gratification or more just relief?
Relief is done. 100% relief.
It's actually hard to derive any joy.
Yeah, like the all the hard parts are done. Yeah, it's a book launch is fun, but it's also stressful, and it comes at a point when it's just been such a long, challenging build up to getting the publication finished and getting it out there and getting it on shelves, that, like, it's at a time when I just need a break, and so it's good to be there and do it. I wish I had more time to relax at a book launch and things like that, but it's usually the sort of week following that I can sort of sit back and reflect and feel a little proud of myself.
So it's completely after the fact when you actually have a bit of nourishment.
I'd say so, yeah.
Not knowing when the first one comes off the printer.
Well, yeah, it's very easy to be very self-critical in what I do as well. Because we work at deadlines and things like that. There's always things that you wish you could do. Guys, We should move on. Linda, have we got
a bit of time?
Yeah. Yeah, so we were going to take a few questions from the audience if anyone wants to ask us anything at all about publishing books, food,
cooking.
Anyone got a question?
I've got a microphone. Want me to bring it
to
you?
Have you got a question, Linda?
On the spot.
On the spot. You were talking about your influences. I'm wondering if you go back to the classics, like do you go to Escoffier's repertoire? Do you go that far back, or you want to modern?
Depends if you like that's a classic book. It's a tome of cooking techniques. So some things, if you want the recipe to a sort of source, then yeah, and you always kind of take everything you kind of taught in college and as a sort of young chef is kind of based on that basic technique. So
you kind of hope you know what.
I mean, like they're probably the perfect representation. Recipe like mayonnaise in Escoffier, like it goes back to that far, like these very basic things you think of.
Well, would you say Escoffier is less of a sort of a source of inspiration and more of a practical guide, like a user's manual?
The latter, definitely.
Yeah. Interesting. I guess it's interesting though how the industry is quite trend driven, and some of these things do come back into fashion. You see it kind of cycle around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's a question.
Here's Munch.
Please introduce yourself.
Yeah. G'day, my name's Anne. I'm actually from Canberra.
Oh, okay. I'm from Canberra.
I've got a book for that, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got a book for that.
My question is whether you like eating. Do you get to eat, or do you just graze all the
time? Definitely get to eat.
Great question.
That business of working with food all the time and your own consumption?
It can be hard. I think there's a lot of chefs actually don't particularly like eating or even like cooking at home, because it's very, very separate things. Cooking in a restaurant is your job, is your trade, and it's different to cooking a meal at home. So a lot of chefs don't particularly like eating or don't like cooking, it's just a job. I think to be the sort of higher end, like myself, definitely, I love eating, I love going out for food. I love cooking at home as well. It's kind of how I became a chef, was from a love of cooking at home first of all. So kind of that was my first thing, was enjoying eating and then sort of cooking things so I can eat them. But it can be tough with the hours we do. Well, I don't get home till gone 11 p.m. sometimes, and then you've got to try and eat, try and get some sleep, and then get up and do it over again. So it's definitely can be a challenge, and it can take some of the joy out of it as well. When you spend the whole time, it's kind of like I think everyone gets it a little bit, if you're cooking for your family and you spend the whole time cooking, and then when you finally sit down, you go, "Oh, I'm not even hungry anymore," and it is kind of a constantly like that. And your whole life is like that. I'm not even hungry anymore.
But you have to get yourself in a really deep routine.
Yeah, I think A lot of people in the industry, or what I experienced a lot, is that, yeah, like you said, Simon, you eat at very, when you're working in the industry, you eat at very strange times. You might have dinner at 4:30 in the afternoon, and then at 11:30 again with whatever's kind of left from service. Random combinations of things. But I personally, when I was working in kitchens, was always snacking along the way as well. Always eating and tasting things.
Chip here and a chip there.
God, I'm never working in a place that serves hot chips again, because I just put on weight. Like,
it's important for, like, I try and teach our young guys to eat properly because they work so much. So they need to look after themselves. And I found when I was young, I was like about probably 8-10 kilos lighter than I am now, if you can imagine it. I had to learn a bit later to look after myself a bit better, get to the gym, eat properly. It's really important when you work so much.
I think I'll knock onto your days off as well, because we basically eat lunch at about 4 p.m. every day. We cook almost every day in the kitchen, the whole meal for all the staff. Then if it's one day off on a Monday, I'm not hungry until 4 p.m. when everyone else is probably eating.
And everything's closed.
Everything's closed for lunch. We're going to eat lunch at 4 p.m. Like, I have dinner at 11 p.m. as well. So it does have a kind of knock on. But I think myself and Andy very much enjoy going to other people's restaurants.
Yeah, love coming out.
And trying to enjoy it and trying not to judge and trying to compare is the other hard part.
You generally get nourished quite well being a part of the food community and going to other people's restaurants as well.
You get a little crushed. It's probably the
word. Yeah.
It's nice going to someone from your nose restaurant and they might send you a couple of extra plates is always good.
Any other questions?
Questions?
Here we go. The microphone.
I'm Isaac. Been to both the restaurants. It's really good to see the quality of food in Wollongong. I think it's really important. Publishing side of things, you mentioned that there was 150 odd places that you could have included in your book. You culled it down from cost reason and all other factors. I think it's a two-part question. How did you decide on who you wanted to have in your book? Did people approach you? Did you go, out and about? And then what helped you with that definitive sort of list for the final book?
Yeah, so it's that's a challenging part at the start. Number one, having worked in hospitality for quite a long time, and then having done these books for quite a while as well, I like to think that I have a pretty good judge. I am a pretty good judge of the quality of a place when I walk in there and have a meal. So it is like I do some research by just going to places and eating. One of the things that I've learned since making the last few books and a little technique, I guess, that I've implemented is starting with people in the industry. So Simon and Tom were some of the first people that I approached about the book because they've got Cabo, and you know that any restaurant with a chef's hat is at the top of the game sort of in a region. And so you want to talk to those people about the food culture of a region. Because some of these places, like the Southern Highlands, I didn't live in the Southern Highlands, but I need to get an understanding of the food culture and the industry in that region in order to be able to accurately represent it in the publication. So I sat down with Tom and Andy and we talked about some of the different, Tom and Simon, and we talked about some of the different places. So definitely getting some information off them was really, really important. There's a lot of other things that came into it. So you need to have diversity in the dishes that are in a book. Each restaurant has about two dishes in the book or something like that, and you can't have two of the same recipe. So you need to think about places that will give you something unique and interesting. A lot of it comes down to also you can sort of gauge the philosophy of people and people who are doing things right in terms of supporting sort of sustainable agriculture and things like that. Even something as simple as making a quality coffee is a really good judge of the quality of a place in general. And so we all these sort of things come into play, and then it's a matter of sort of working with people in the industry and constantly sort of I didn't have a list at the start, and that was the final list. Some people say no, some people don't want to be a part of it. It's something that's constantly evolving as I meet new people, as I go and do photo shoots, as I do interviews with people and start connecting with members of the industry.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of people when we sort of first met and you had a basic list of a couple of people we suggested that we were friends with or we liked, that we thought deserved to be in a book about the Illawarra, was sort of added as well. So definitely, myself and Tom and Steph kind of had a chat about who we thought should be in, and Steph sort of took that and made his decisions.
And just as a bit of inside info, I guess, that part of the process can be one of the most nerve-wracking and stressful things. And to get the support of Simon and Tom straight away makes it a huge help, because people, when I come to do a book in a new region, people don't know who I am. I can show them my previous publications, but I can go to a restaurant like Biota or Echelon or a really nice restaurant in the Southern Highlands, and they don't know me. But I have to try to get it across the line for them to entrust me to not only represent their restaurant and their food well and accurately in a publication, but also represent the quality of food culture in that region well as well. So they're putting a bunch of trust in me, and it's a big ask from just a random person walking in off the street with a book saying, hey, I want to do one of these.
I think you were lucky. It was that within the first 6 months we'd been owning a business.
Exactly, yeah.
We were still keen for everyone. Then we're like, oh, book, let's do it, yeah.
What was the second part of the question again, sorry?
I think you sort of answered everything. I'm sort of just how you narrowed it down. And if you approach people, or if people heard that you were making a book and yeah. really wanted to be a part of it, sort of.
Sometimes people approach me, generally after I've made a publication, when people come to me and say, I want to be in number two. And it's at that point that I have to be ruthlessly dictatorial, in the sense that everyone wants to be a part of a publication, but not everyone can be in one for reasons that I kind of explained before. But at the same time, it's like everyone thinks they're great. Like everyone thinks what they do is great. No one's opening a cafe or a restaurant or whatever thinking that we'll make a substandard product and try to find a market for it. So it is hard. But I don't know, we tend to try. We tend to get it right. I guess one of the other hard things is like having places that are going to be around for the lifespan of a book as well. That sort of had some longevity in the industry. We can't have a book that you feature a restaurant and a month later it closes, because then it degrades the quality of the publication.
Is anyone closed from the?
The Postman's in the rule have recently changed to Para, so they're the Postman's in the book, but they've changed their name and sort of what they do. Yeah. Any more questions?
Kind of out of time anyway.
Out of time? Let me do the last thing, Linda, sorry. Okay.
No, you're fine.
The Illawarra Cookbook is about Wollongong. It's available at the bookshop. Sorry, I've got a plug.
Yeah, plug away.
This is the new book that's launching tomorrow. It's about a restaurant in Barrow called Bistro Officina. It's a restaurant that's only powered by fire, so there's no gas or electricity in the kitchen. It's just wood ovens, wood grills, and that sort of thing. And it's about the chef, Nicola Cochet, his story of cooking in Europe, coming to Australia, moving to the Southern Highlands, and opening a restaurant. And there's some really cool recipes in that one. And they're available over there as well. And if you want any more information about what we do, quicksandfood.com is the website. Quickly plug your stuff, guys.
Kavo.com on the website, Kavo_restaurant on Instagram, and similar on Facebook.
At Babyface Kitchen, at 2_smokingbarrels on Instagram. And our website's Birdsbury Hospitality.
Okay, cool. And if you want to listen to any other episodes of the Gong Show podcast, you can search it on iTunes and wherever you get podcasts. Search Quicksand Food or whatever. We also have it on all our social media, and we've done plenty of episodes previously. We're actually doing an interesting one on Tuesday about mental health and the hospitality industry. It's a high pressure, high stress thing, so there's good ones coming up and stuff as well. So tell your friends, and then also if anyone couldn't make it today that you know that would like to have heard this conversation, they can go back and listen to it as well. And thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. That's
another
Long Show podcast.